You know, when I first started coming to these meetings, they used to be called S7 or S3, and it was very intimidating to come because there were all these older people, mostly old guys, but some older women, who basically did what Helga did in a lot of ways. Oh, we've known that for 50 years, you know, why are you telling us that? So it was really intimidating to come here as a graduate student. Now, it's really a pleasure. I think Helga's talk was just a great kickoff. I swear we did not conspire before this, but I had hoped to talk a lot about models and the assumptions underlying them and how they need to be questioned. And in the interest of having a talk that didn't last 2 hours, I cut all that out and really am presenting some empirical data. But I think it'll lead to an interesting discussion down the line when we start talking about potential. And I hope I don't bring up a zombie idea. I think Helga just left the room. So did she?
No, she's here.
Oh, there. You used to be over there. Okay. So if I have a zombie idea or two, you know, so be it. How do I control the slides?
Arrow key and a laser pointer there to the side.
Where's the laser?
Oh,
is this it?
The slides.
Okay. It was hidden behind the screen. So so this is it?
That's new to me.
Oh, that's
the laptop here.
Oh, on the laptop.
Yeah. And the laser.
Oh, there it is. Okay. All right. So, also, I'd like to thank Luke and Brian and Jeff. I'm only 6'3", so I'll behave. I'm older too, but I'm still tough as nails. So I want to actually talk about some of the assumptions we make and use data to address it. And one is that. The term linear relationship between detrital input rates and soil carbon accumulation is a bit odd mathematically. What we mean by that is that the sensory type models, and they were and are useful, but they can be misleading in their output and may not be biologically and pedologically realistic, but there's typically an implicit assumption in them that a certain fraction of the litter and detritus is going to decompose relatively quickly, and maybe 15 or 20% or some empirically set percentage is going to be transferred to that SOM pool, that soil organic matter or carbon pool. And then, as Helga said, that's going to turn over at some slow turnover rate, which may be climatically determined, may be determined by the chemistry of the litter that formed that SOM. But I think that's really in question. And so, the question is, does soil carbon increase as plant inputs increase to soil needs to be addressed. And I'd like to thank my collaborators, of course, Rich Bowden, Susan Crow, and Kate Lloyd, who we've been working together as a team for decades on this, Susan more recently, who's Kate's student. And we have we've built a network called the DIRT Network. And when I first came to soil science meetings, I was offending people because DIRT is not a good word in soil science, but that's part of the charm. And Francis Hole, who we worked with to start these experiments, really embraced the term DIRT. He liked it a lot. And if you ever knew Francis, that was the seal of approval for us. So, we all know this as soil scientists, that the soil pool is huge. It's hard to estimate. The atmospheric pool is one-half to one-third or even one-fourth of this pool. That's well known. In fact, when we started making measurements or the measurements we can infer back to the turn of the last century, we've increased this pool by a third. So pre-industrial, it was 600 billion metric tons, petagram, and now it's 816. That's a very well-known pool. Biomass and detritus is about 500 billion metric tons, more or less. And there's evidence from face experiments and other sources that this pool is increasing, that net primary productivity is increasing. And for multiple reasons, longer growing seasons perhaps, warmer temperatures, maybe more soil mineralization, maybe the CO2 fertilization effect, higher CO2 leading to higher primary productivity. Face sites seem to show that. So, and the big question, of course, that we all get funded on is, well, if this soil organic matter pool destabilizes, either in the Arctic or temperate forests, it's going to add more carbon to an already increasing carbon dioxide, already carbon-rich atmosphere. And on the other hand, if conditions allow, and a storage is actually a percentage of NPP or litter inputs into ground, then soil could provide an ecological and a social service by storing some of this excess carbon. We still don't really know how to answer that. But maybe a zombie idea, I don't think it's gone so far as to be a zombie idea yet, but it's an idea that needs to be tested, and notice there's no units on this. The question is, will increasing primary productivity and increasing detrital inputs to soils increase soil organic matter carbon? And, you know, that seems, if you run the simplest of sensory type or BGC or even PNET models, which my advisor developed, you'll see this. Higher NPP, given a stable climate, will result in higher soil organic matter carbon input. Of course, then the other second level question is, if the climate, if we have longer growing seasons, moisture changes, you know, that might not occur. But answering the fundamental question about the relationship between magnitude of inputs and direction of change in soil carbon is still something we haven't done. Here's a part of a figure from someone named Todd Brown, last name Todd Brown. I don't know if it's a male or female. If you're in the room, I'd really like talking with you. I think this paper in Biogeosciences is worth everyone reading. Earth system modelers are trying to figure out the relationships between primary productivity and soil carbon storage. And when they hindcast, and these are 11 different Earth system models, all of which have some of the assumptions that Helga talked about in the below ground carbon modeling pool, you see there's quite a range in primary productivity. Most of the average is around 65 billion metric tons per year of primary productivity. And there's generally a rough relation between soil carbon storage as a result of this primary productivity and the productivity of the models. But they all sort of couple the vegetation and the soil modules differently. Whoops. If we ask these models to forecast into the 21st century, they're all over the map. Soil carbon is basically not predictable. I would challenge you to say, well, let's take the average of 11 Earth system models, and that's what soil carbon storage is going to be. Now, these models are modeling, this is under a business-as-usual scenario with CO2 increasing and temperature increasing, but you can see that the coupling between NPP and also the NPP variation is quite high, but the variation in soil carbon storage is really variable and not linked to productivity. So this is a really important point. The models don't have it yet, and we all and our collaborators need to provide the process level information to inform these models. Taking a slice out of one of the tables in Todd Brown, let's just look at forest, and these are biomes, but these are all these 11 models. This is the total soil carbon stored between the last decade and the decade at the end of the current century. And, you know, I don't like big, busy tables like this, but this table, look at the extremes, even in temperate forests. Plus 11 billion metric tons stored to minus 4. And if we go to tropical and boreal forests, and boreal forests where all that soil carbon is, the range is incredible, minus 28 to almost to over 60. Can we take the mean of these? No. Okay. I would talk more about models, but thank you, Helga, for. So what explains this variance? Joel and Ethan Cohn helped me with this slide, I got to tell you something. So there's the gravitas in the black, white on black. That's why I wore a black suit. Anyway, what explains it? Well, one of the things we've put together over the years is a sort of a growing network we call the detritus experiment, the DIRT experiment, detritus input and removal treatments. This is a long-term intersite experiment, and when I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin, I accidentally got to be good friends with Francis Hole. We rode the bus together, and we talk about soils in the back, and Francis, I have to scale back and talk about people. Francis was wonderful. He was a Quaker. He was a very simple person. He was a pacifist. He had to wear a yellow stripe during World War II because he wouldn't fight, because he was a Quaker. And he wore workman's gloves and just an old trench coat from the Salvation Army store. But he's brilliant. And we'd sit in the back of the bus and talk about soil and dirt, you know, and people would think, this is really weird. Here's an old guy with gloves and a young graduate student talking about soil. But anyway, he started an experiment in the University of Wisconsin Arboretum in 1956 when the Arboretum was being constructed to recreate ecosystems in Wisconsin. And so John Curtis, who was heading this up, asked Francis, as a young soil scientist, what should we do? And he said, well, what we should do is we should do a simple long-term experiment where we would, you know, he was thinking about Hans Jenny, and he said, let's take the vegetation and see how it affects soils by manipulating the amounts of inputs to those soils. And Francis did that, and I was infatuated with the idea of a simple experiment. And when I went to Woods Hole in 1983, I proposed to go back and sample the plots that he started in 56. The University of Wisconsin, in its infinite wisdom, decided to end that experiment in 2006, which is a shame because when Francis retired, they asked him, how long should we keep these experiments up, Dr. Hull? And he literally said, oh, at least 1,000 years. And, well, it went 50. So, and the original experiment was basically find some plots without trees, arrange your plots between the trees, and remove the litter from plots so that you end above ground inputs. Take that litter and put it in double litter plots. So break the litter in the fall, put in double litter plots. Francis also was interested in impoverishment, so he took the top 20 inches of soil, and back in the 50s they measured soil profiles in inches, I guess, and replaced it with B horizon material. So the idea is, how does an impoverished soil recover its organic matter stocks and its fertility? So we call that the OA less. When I started the second dirt plot at Harvard Forest, we decided to focus on the roots. So we trenched plots. We dug trenches around plots, and we lined them with what we thought were impermeable barriers, which seemed to hold out the roots for about 10 years max, and then you have to redo it. So we had no roots plots, but normal litter. And then we have these plots that have no nothing. They're trenched, and we keep the litter off. So we have a gradient of inputs to vegetation that we can look at the effects on soil biota and soil properties over short and long terms. When Kate Loida added a dirt site to the H.J. Andrews LTER site, as you'll see in a minute, this is a very wood-rich system, and as easily as much litter falls as fine twigs and bark and wood as leaves. So she did a double carbon input by adding equivalent amount of carbon and leaf litter as chopped up wood. We did the same thing at the UM Biological Station, the newest dirt site. And at the biostation, because of some recent research showing the potential effects of N additions on soils and affecting soil organic matter turnover, we added a nitrogen addition treatment as well. So we have a lot. So let's look at the University of Wisconsin Arboretum. This was an oak forest that was really never totally cut, it was used as a farm woodlot, two oak forests actually. When I first sampled these soils in 54, in 1984, after 28 years of research, I was just impressed. You know, E.O. Wilson said we should really focus on art. Science is great and we need it, but art is what people do. So I decided to make a little artsy thing with the soils from the 0 to 10 centimeter depth and lower. And you can see, students, if you're here, don't think about numbers, think about what it looks like. Here's the control soil, 0 to 10 centimeter composite mix, and here's the layer below it. Double litter is darker, even in the lower part. And we're really talking about depths here, not horizons. This is an alfasol, by the way, so fine, relatively fine textured soil. No litter, you can see the color disappearing, and of course A-less probably started out something like this light, and now it's accumulating carbon. So in 1984, when I went back to Wisconsin from Woods Hole, I sampled these plots, and the double litter, predictably, as I thought, had increased in carbon content. This is really the wrong unit. We should be talking about carbon per meter squared. But in any case, this is about a 30% increase, and it represents about 20% of the estimated total litter inputs over that 20 years. So it fits nicely with the century model. You know, litter's decomposing, 80% of it's going up as CO2, and 20% of it's being stored as humus. And you take away the litter, and about equivalent amount leaves. This is a replicate. This is a different woods. This is Winger Woods, which is just over the road, and it's actually a little sandier. And notice that the increases are higher and the decreases are deeper. And we'll get back to texture. And by the way, I don't know when I started, and so 5 minutes before you want me to sit down, just tell me. And we went back in two subsequent years, 1997 and most recently in 2006, and what had happened, apparently, is these sites reached some sort of equilibrium value. So the SOM pool was building up, but if it's turning over at a constant rate, the exports eventually reach the level of imports. So we get a new equilibrium. That's the linear relation we expect, and you might expect that if you parameterized a sensory-type model or a PNET-type model. So that's 50 years of chronic litter doubling or exclusion, and of course the experiment is now over, unfortunately. I'm only going to present a little bit of data from multiple sites. There's a real rich data site that's emerging, a lot of things, a lot of papers, but I want to highlight some of the things that relate to exactly what Helga was talking about, I think. This is Harvard Forest. Harvard Forest is on a spodosol, rocky, forest, well-developed forest floor, acidic. This is just a no-litter plot, just to show you. And there's me, and I can't tell who these people are, so I'm not trying to be egotistical, but that's the best shot I had. There's Rich Bowden, however. And Rich, when we sampled in 2010, managed to acquire a really fancy soil core so we could split a lot of samples among a lot of researchers. And getting back to what a point Helga made, so these are the treatment effects after 20 years at Harvard Forest on the O horizon. So you can see when we doubled litter, we did actually boost the O horizon carbon content. When we excluded roots, we diminished it significantly by a factor of about 5. And, of course, no inputs and no litter have basically led to the degradation of the O horizon. But if you look below the O horizon at any slice of the soils in 10 centimeter or down low, a 20 centimeter increment, there's no difference at all between treatments after 20 years. Surprising. We would expect that hydrological flow and transport to have some effect. So the total mineral soil, there's no effective treatment that we can detect, which was quite a surprise to us, actually. We've done a lot of work on microbial and fungal communities, not myself, but my collaborators. Here's and we've done enzymology. This is from Kate's collaborator, Bruce, and I've forgotten his last name. Caldwell, thank you. So Bruce did phosphyl monoesterase and beta-glucosidase measurements, and you can see that, you know, in the double litter plots, those enzyme activities are higher. In the no-litter plots, they're lower. There's more substrate to work on. There's a more active microbial community. I want to step away from Dirk for a minute and talk about some of the work we've been doing for 20 years on chronic N effects on forests. And a lot of you might have read papers by myself or John Aber or other people about the Harvard Forest Chronic N Edition. Basically, what we did was we started this experiment in the late 80s to simulate N deposition at 50 kilograms per hectare, which is about the highest N deposition you can measure in North America or Europe. And we found that it had very little effect on net primary productivity. Measurable, and we put way too much nitrogen on this high fertilization. Nothing in the world gets 150 kilograms per hectare except maybe cornfields. There was no effect of fertilization on primary productivity until we fertilized with 150 kilograms per hectare per year. But what we did find when we sampled in 2008 was an increase in soil organic carbon in both an oak forest and a fertilized red pine forest, which was curious. Why is that? So, and Don's act studying oak and maple forest responses to N fertilization at 30 kilograms per hectare from southern to northern Michigan has found the same phenomenon. A lot of other research is now showing N additions to soils are resulting in preserved organic carbon. We did some isotope work labeling forests in Europe and North America that we reported in Nature in 2001, or was it 99? Sorry, long time ago. That showed most of the N deposition was going to soil organic matter and not to vegetation, 80% on average across 11 sites. So what's the effect of that N deposition on SOM? At the Busone Forest, which is a different vegetation type, the sugar maple site, but again on a sandy soil, and Rich Bowden is a professor at Allegheny College, which runs Busone. There they are sampling. After 20 years of dirt treatments, this is what, so the darkness of the bar represents the amount of litter of detritus going in. So double litter is dark, control is this gray shade, no litter, no roots, no nada, no nothing. Nicked. Zilch. So, can't find an increase after 20 years in this sugar maple forest of carbon in any layer. You can find decreases with no litter or no inputs. There are significant decreases in some horizons, and if you add all these horizons up, and for some reason the stars didn't show up here, the no litter and the no inputs are the only sites that differ from the controls. 20 years of doubling sugar maple inputs or 20 years of excluding roots in this particular site didn't affect soil organic matter carbon. It's amazing. You know, the models say this shouldn't happen, but these are real measurements done by the same people using the same techniques, 0 and 20 years. The Andrews site, and this is a nice picture of this is a Douglas fir site with lots of organic matter, lots of needles. This is Kate Lloyd, his son Adrian, helping. One of the things, I don't credit all the sources of support for this. NSF has helped support this through LTER, DOE has, but lots of diverse sources. Most of it's been bootlegged, frankly. Most of it's just us going out there without funds. Kate had an RCN from NSF, but I would say 80% of the work has been, we just want to do this, so we're going to do it and figure out how. So there's, and we employ family members to help us, so there's Adrian. child labor. I hope there are no, child welfare people. Adrian likes doing this in the audience. It was during school vacation. We didn't take him out of school. So this is, we've sort of modified the treatments, as I mentioned earlier. The Busone Forest has no roots. Harvard Forest has no OA treatment. Andrews doesn't. But the main point here is this is soil carbon pools control. Here is Andrews with double wood, no increase. Double litter, a decrease. No inputs, no litter, no roots, all increases. That's after 16 years. Busone, more or less the same pattern. Nothing we can do there to increase soil organic matter stocks. And at Harvard Forest, after 30 years, I showed you no increase in double litter. And so at the biological station in northern Michigan, this is, I like to say, not KBS. We are friends with Kellogg Biological Station, but we're not LPR. We are in a forested region, and we started a dirt experiment there a year after I became director. This is our forest is about 100-year-old regrowing mixed oak, red pine, birch, aspen, giving way to those species, and some white pine. It's a beautiful soil because it's almost all just pure sand, and so it's kind of a E. coli of soils. There's no rocks. You can really sample things well, and they respond rapidly to any manipulation. So this is ours. We basically have an expanded dirt treatment that includes not only the double litter, the no input, the no leaves, and the no roots, also wood to compare with Andrews. And then we have fertilization treatments, 30 kilograms per hectare per year added to control non-manipulated sites and fertilizer added to double litter. And this is So our first treatment year was 2004, and the black bars show, you know, some variation, but nothing detectable. We just started the treatments. Then 5 years later, two things happened. One is the actual carbon content went down, and this is another topic we need to really address. We had an earthworm invasion at the biological station about 50 years ago, but what we've learned from my students, Jasmine Crumsey, who just got her PhD in 2014, is that these earthworms come and go. There's a patch dynamic with them. They degrade the O horizon, their local population disappears, and then they invade another area where the whole horizon is built up, and they work on that for a while, and they move around. So while after we set this experiment up, earthworms moved in, and they basically degraded the carbon in all the sites except for the double litter fert. And the double litter fert is the only treatment that actually increases carbon stocks in the face of that earthworm invasion. So there's something about the nitrogen that's going into the soil that's arresting the decomposition of the SOM, we think. The double litter actually decreased. And, of course, the no inputs, I mean, this is a sandy soil, there's very little aggregation. It's just toast. And the wood inputs actually decreased. So we're adding more carbon as wood. Okay, 5 minutes. Thanks. And so this is the net change in stocks. Double litter decreased, carbon control decreased, double litter fert is the only thing that increased. Let's go to Hungary. So here's Kate. Tim Philly works with us. Susan Crow, whose work I'll show, and then our Hungarian collaborators, whose names not only can I not remember, I can't even pronounce. But they're wonderful collaborators. And this is some Bruce Caldwell's enzyme data from Busan Experimental Forest, Harvard Forest, Sikfukut, which is the Hungarian, and H.J. Andrews. So this is beta-glucosidase. This is an enzyme that tears apart cellulose. And you can see in the double litter plots, there's often a significant increase in beta-glucosidase activity at Busan and Harvard Forest. Sikfukut, a trend. H.J. Andrews, not so much. There's so much litter there anyway, I think you can't really boost anything. So the basic message here is that when you increase litter, you increase the enzyme activity. And we have all kinds of soil microbial community measures too, but I won't, the main point is I'll make in a second. So back to Busan again, our H.J. Andrew, that big temperate rainforest Douglas fir. We've done this with all the soils from the dirt sites that we look at. We incubate them in the lab, and I know there are problems with lab incubations, but they do give you a mineralization potential, and this is the carbon released per unit carbon in soil in double litter and control. So actually, I think that is reversed. Yeah. No, the double litter, okay, so the double litter, pardon? Pardon?
It looks like a scratch.
Yeah, no, it is, right. Exactly, the declining quality of the double litter, and that's, I think, consistent with the decline in amount. So we basically burned off a lot of the labile stuff. When we looked at the DOC in soils, at 30 centimeters and 100 centimeters, you can see this extinction of DOC. You know, this is energy-rich stuff that's being processed between 30 and 100 centimeters, so it's doing something. Think back about some of Helga's work. The double wood DOC in particular, the double litter DOC, they're all attenuating. So that extra DOC that's resulting from that extra litter is being processed. And if you look at the chemistry, you see changes in hydrophilic, hydrophobic compounds. But basically, the more labile compounds are disappearing from the double litter at 30 centimeters soil solution. This is DOC concentrations, just total across all chemistries at 30 centimeter in double litter versus control, more consumption in the double litter. Okay, Susan Crow wrote a paper addressing priming, and I know I'm running out of time, so I'm going to be quick here. But this is basically field measured CO2 fluxes. Here's double litter, here's control, so there's higher respiration and control. Soil and air temperature, precipitation, and then she measured priming by two methods. One by Kuziakoff's method, which has been published in two papers, which basically assumes a first-order decay constant for both litter and SOM, and uses the mismatch in respiration as predicted by first-order decay constants to estimate priming effects. And this is the priming effect, the percent increase in the gray bars using the Kuziakoff model. We develop another estimate of priming, which is to take the respiration from the different treatments. And basically, there's a paper by Rich Bowden in biogeochemistry about 10 years ago explains how we did this. But we can estimate the contribution of above-ground litter, below-ground litter, and SOM to what respiration should be, measure this after 16 years, and the mismatch, again, is the priming effect. So we could see a priming effect measurable in 7 of the 12 months here, and always positive. This is basically a conceptual idea of Kuziakoff's priming model. This is the priming effect at H.J. Andrews as measured using Susan Crowe's model, which incorporates our dirt treatments. And you can read Susan Crowe's model in Forest Ecology and Management for details on this. So I think, you know, we're just about over. But Kuziakoff has this priming model which focused on DOC exudates from roots. I think when you add an increase in litter and DOM to the mix, it has the same effect. You have a high-energy substrate that feeds a large bacterial community, gives it the energy to produce enzymes to decompose this SOM. And the problem with the sensory-type models is they disconnect the SOM decomposition from the litter. So what happens to all this extra energy that's feeding the microbial communities that are decomposing litter? And those microbial communities are nitrogen-starved. They're producing enzymes to mine this SOM and drive it off into the atmosphere. That's a conceptual model. It's not my model, but I think this is consistent with what DIRT's showing us. I want to get back to earthworms and bioturbation very briefly. Jasmine Crumsey, who just finished her PhD, looked at the effects of invasive earthworms in northern Michigan on soil organic matter dynamics. She's now postdocing at Cornell with Jed Spark. She did a bunch of mesocosm experiments with earthworm communities. This experiment that I'm going to briefly talk about was used dual-labeled red maple litter, highly labeled with C13 and N15. To see what the earthworms, how they would process it. So this is a paper from her thesis that we're preparing to resubmit. On the left side is this typical sandy soil from the biological station, almost no clay, almost no silt. This is a sandy loam from a relatively smaller part of the forest that has some silt and clay. And without earthworms, only 3% after 150 days of that red maple carbon was moved into the soil profile. With earthworms in the sandy soil, a third of it was moved into the profile, 5% of it was left on the surface, and the rest of it was respired as CO2. If you take a sandy loam soil with more silt, more clay, look what happens when you add earthworms. No earthworms. For some reason, the sandy loam soil is richer, more decomposition, more incorporation of that carbon into the soil, but when you add the earthworms, soil recovery was 80% of that carbon in the SOM across three layers. And so earthworms have an effect, and it interacts with texture. So overall, the dirt work and some of the N addition work we've done and some of the earthworm work shows forest SOM pool size does not always increase with NPP and litter inputs. We have to understand the processes. We're a long way from that. Increasing litter inputs can lead to increasing SOM stocks in coarse textured soils, and the priming effect is the suspected mechanism. But I think more work needs to be done on that too. But our manipulations suggest the priming of SOM, in other words, the increased turnover with high C-N, energy-rich, nutrient-poor litter is a plausible explanation for why SOM is decreasing, paradoxically, I think, with increased inputs. Fine textured soils appear to store more SOM with increased litter inputs. I think Hans Jenny, of course, that's not new, but it's interesting to compare coarse versus fine textured soils. And elevated N inputs can offset priming effects and sustain SOM. Not that I'm advocating we have more N deposition and more air pollution, but that's a scientific fact, I think. So, thank you.
Thank you.